Emma Bovary swallows the stuff due to several unhappy affairs, I said. Dogger studiously scraped a clod of mud from the sole of his shoe with the hoe. She had an affair with a man named Rodolphe, I added, and then with another named Leon. Not at the same time, of course.
Of course, Dogger said, and then fell silent.
What does an affair entail, precisely? I asked, hoping my choice of words would imply, even slightly, that I already knew the answer. I thought for a moment that I could outwait him, even though my heart knew that trying to outwait Dogger was a mug's game. What did Flaubert mean, I asked at last, when he said that Madame Bovary gave herself up to Rodolphe?
He meant, Dogger said, that they became the greatest of friends, the very greatest of friends.
Ah, I said, just as I thought.
Dogger, come up here at once before I do myself some grave internal injury. Aunt Felicity's voice came trumpeting down from an upstairs window. Coming, Miss Felicity, he called out, and then, in an aside to me, he said, Miss Felicity requires assistance with her luggage.
Luggage? I asked. She's leaving?
Dogger nodded noncommittally.
Jeez, I exclaimed.
It was a secret prayer whose meaning was known only to God and to me.
Aunt Felicity was already halfway down the west staircase in a canvas outfit that suggested Africa rather than the wilds of Hampstead. Clarence Mundy's taxicab was at the door, and Dogger was helping Bert hoist Aunt Felicity's cargo aboard.
"We're going to miss you, Aunt Fee," Feely said.
"Aunt Fee?" It seemed that in my absence, Feely had been ingratiating herself with Father's sister, most likely, I thought, in the hope of inheriting the Deluce family jewels, that ghastly collection of gewgaws that my grandfather Deluce, on Father's and Aunt Felicity's side, had foisted upon my grandmother who, as she received each piece, had dropped it, with thumb and forefinger, into a pasteboard box as casually as if it were a grass snake, and never looked at it again. Feely had wasted the entire afternoon slavering over this rubbish the last time we had gone up to Hampstead for one of Aunt Felicity's compulsory teas.
"So romantic," she had breathed when Aunt Felicity had, rather grudgingly, I thought, lent her a pink glass pendant that would not have been out of place on a cow's udder. "I shall wear it to Rosalind Norton's coming out, and all eyes will be on yours truly."
Poor Rosalind. She's such an awful sweat. "I'm sorry it's turned out this way, Haviland," Aunt Felicity bellowed from the landing, "but you've well and truly botched it. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put your accounts together again. I should, of course, be more than happy to rescue you from your excesses if I weren't so heavily invested in consols. There's nothing for it now but to sell those ridiculous postage stamps." Father had drifted so silently into the hall that I had not noticed him until now. He stood, one hand holding Daffy's arm, his eyes downcast, as if he were intently studying the black and white tiles beneath his feet.
"Thank you for coming, Felicity," he said quietly, without looking up. "It was most kind of you."
I wanted to swat the woman's face. I had actually taken half a step forward before a firm hand fell on my shoulder, stopping me in my tracks. It was Dogger.
"Will there be anything else, Miss Felicity?" he asked.
"No, thank you, Dogger," she said, rummaging in her reticule with two fingers. From its depths, like a stork pulling a fish from a pond, she extracted what looked like a shilling and handed it to him with a sigh.
"Thank you, miss," he said, pocketing the insult with ease and without looking at it, as if it was something he did every day.
And with that, Aunt Felicity was gone. A moment later, Father had stepped into the shadows of the great hall, followed closely by Daffy and Feely, and Dogger had vanished without a word into his little corridor behind the stairs. It was like one of those electric moments just before the final curtain in a West End play. That moment when all the supporting characters have faded into the wings, leaving the heroine alone at center stage to deliver her magnificent closing line to a silent house that awaited her words with bated breath. "Bloody hell," I said, and stepped outdoors for a breath of fresh air. "The problem with We Deluces," I decided, "is that we are infested with history in much the same way that other people are infested with lice. There have been Deluces at Buckshaw since King Harold stopped an arrow with his eye at the Battle of Hastings, and most of them have been unhappy in one complicated way or another. We seem to be born with wisps of both glory and gloom in our veins, and we can never be certain, at any given moment, which of the two is driving us. On the one hand, I knew I would never be like Aunt Felicity, but on the other, would I ever become like Harriet? 8 years after her death, Harriet was still as much a part of me as my toenails, although that's probably not the best way of putting it. I read the books that she had owned, rode her bicycle, sat in her Rolls Royce. Father had once, in a distracted moment, called me by her name. Even Aunt Felicity had put aside her Gorgon manner long enough to tell me how much like Harriet I was. But had she meant it as a compliment? Or a warning? Most of the time, I felt like an imposter, a changeling, a sackcloth and ashes stand-in for that golden girl who had been snatched up by fate and dashed down a mountainside in an impossibly distant land. Everyone, it seemed, would be so much happier if Harriet were brought back to life and I were done away with. These thoughts and others tumbled in my mind like autumn leaves in a millstream as I walked along the dusty lane towards the village. Without even noticing them, I had passed the carved griffins of the Mulford gates, which marked the entrance to Buckshaw, and I was now within sight of Bishop's Lacey. As I slouched along, a bit dejectedly, all right, I admit it, I was furious at Aunt Felicity for making such a chump of Dogger. I shoved my hand into my pocket, and my fingers came in contact with a round, metallic object. Something that hadn't been there before. A coin. "Hello," I said. "What's this?" I pulled it out and looked at it. As soon as I saw the thing, I knew what it was and how it had made its way into my pocket. I turned it over and had a jolly good squint at the reverse. Yes, there could be no doubt about it. No doubt whatsoever.
Chapter 24. As I looked at it from across the high street, the St. Nicholas Tea Room was like a picture postcard of ye old England. Its upstairs rooms, with their tiny paned bow windows, had been the residence of the present Mr. Sowbell's grandparents in the days when they had lived above their coffin and furniture manufactory. The Sowbell tables, sideboards and commodes, once known far and wide for the ferocity of their black shine and the gleam of their ornate silver knobs and drawer pulls, had now fallen out of favour and were often to be found at estate sales, standing sullen and alone in the driveway until being knocked down at the end of the day for little more than a pound or two. "By unscrupulous sharpers who use the wood to turn Woolworth's dresses into antiques," Daffy had once told me. The undertaker's shop, I noticed, now had a cardboard clock stuck in its window, suspended from an inverted V of black cord. The minute hand pointed to 12, and the hour hand was missing. Mr. Sowbell had obviously gone to the 13 Drakes for his afternoon pint. I crossed the street and, opening the tea room door, stepped inside. To my right was a steep wooden staircase with a painted blue hand pointing upwards. Tea room upstairs. Beside the stairs, a dim, narrow passageway vanished into the gloom at the rear of the building. On the wall, another helpful painted hand, this one in red and marked Gentlemen's and Ladies' Water Closets,
pointed the way discreetly. I knew that the tea shop and the undertakers shared the WC. Feely had insisted on dragging us here for tea one autumn afternoon, and I had been gobsmacked at the sight of three women in black dresses and black veils, chattering happily away at the door to the toilet like a congress of toothy crows, before resuming their grim demeanours and slipping back into Mr. Sowbell's premises. The door through which they had vanished opened directly into the undertaker's rooms. I was right. A discreet Sowbell and Sons, lettered in gold upon the dark varnish, must have been meant to remind mourners not to go blundering off into the tea shop's corridor after they had soaped their hands, as Mrs. Mullet put it. The black panelled door swung open on silent hinges. I found myself in a dark Victorian parlour with flocked wallpaper of black and yellow cream. On three sides of the room were spindly wooden chairs and a small round table with a spray of artificial baby's breath. The place smelled of dust, with an underlying chemical base. The wall at the far end of the room was bare, save for a dark frame print of Millet's Angelus, in which a man and a woman, obviously Flemish peasants, stand alone in a field at sunset. The woman's huge hands, which are those of a labourer, are clasped at her breast in prayer. The man has removed his hat, which he holds clutched uncomfortably in front of him. He has set aside his fork and stuck it half into the loose earth. As crows congregate above them like vultures, the couple stands with downcast eyes. Between them, half empty on the ground, lies a wicker basket. Max White had once told me that when the original of Millet's painting was exhibited in America, the sale of prints had been sluggish at best until someone thought of changing the name from Angelus to Burying the Baby. It was beneath this print, I guessed, that the coffins were customarily parked. Since the spot was empty, it was obvious that Rupert's body, if it was still on the premises, must be in another room. To my right was an L-shaped partition. There had to be another door behind it. I peered round behind the half wall and found myself looking into a room that was nearly the twin of the first. The only difference that I could see was that the flocked wallpaper was black and pink cream, and the print on the far wall was Holman Hunt's Light of the World, in which Jesus stands at the door like Diogenes, seeking an honest man, with a tin lantern in his hand. Beneath its dark frame, on trestles, was a coffin. I crept towards it on tiptoe, my ears tuned for the slightest sound. I ran my fingers along the highly polished woodwork, the way one might caress a piano lid, before lifting it to reveal the keys. I put my thumbs under the join and felt it lift slightly. I was in luck. The lid was not screwed down. I lifted it and looked inside. There, like a doll in a box, lay Rupert. In life, his personality had made him seem so much larger. I had forgotten how small he really was. Was I frightened out of my wits?
I'm afraid not.
Since the day I had found a body in the kitchen garden at Buckshaw, I had developed a fascination with death, with a particular emphasis on the chemistry of putrefaction. In fact, I had already begun making notes for a definitive work which I would call Deleuze on Decomposition, in which I would outline step by step the process of human cadaveric decay. How exciting it was to reflect upon the fact that, within minutes of death, the organs of the body, lacking oxygen, begin to digest themselves. Ammonia levels start to rise and, with the assistance of bacterial action, methane, better known as marsh gas, is produced, along with hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide and mercaptan, a captivating sulfur alcohol in whose structure sulfur takes the place of oxygen, which accounts for its putrid smell. How curious it was, I thought, that we humans had taken millions of years to crawl up out of the swamps, and yet, within minutes of death, we were already tobogganing back down the slope. My keen sense of smell told me that Mr. Sowbell had used a formalin-based embalming fluid on Rupert, A 2% solution of formaldehyde seemed most likely, with a slight bouquet of something else. Chloroform, by the smell of it? And by the slight green tint at the end of Rupert's nose, I could tell that the undertaker had skimped on the ingredients. One could only hope that the lying in state at the BBC would be a closed coffin affair.
Better hurry up, though, I thought. Mr. Sowbell might walk in at any moment.
Rupert's pale hands were folded across his abdomen, with the right hand uppermost. I took hold of his fingers. It was like lifting link sausages from the icebox, and pulled upwards. To my amazement, his left hand came with it, and I saw at once that they had been cunningly sewn together. By twisting the cold hands and bending down for a better look beneath them, I saw what I was looking for. A blackened channel that ran from the base of his left thumb to the tips of his first and second fingers. In spite of Mr. Sowbell's embalming efforts, Rupert was still giving off rather a scorched smell. And there could be no doubt about it, the burn on the palm of his left hand was the precise width of the lever that operated Galligantus. A floorboard creaked. As I closed the coffin lid, the door opened and Mr. Sowbell walked into the room. I hadn't heard him coming. Because I was still in a half-crouch from inspecting Rupert's burned fingers, I was able to come slowly to a standing position.
Amen, I said, crossing myself extravagantly.
What on earth? Said Mr. Sowbell.
Oh, hello, Mr. Sowbell, I said in an appropriately hushed tone. I just dropped in to pay my respects. There was no one here, but I thought a quiet prayer would be in order.
Mr. Pawson had no friends in Bishop's Lacey, you know, I added, pulling a handkerchief from my pocket and wiping away an imaginary tear. It seems such a shame, and I thought it would do no harm if I... I'm sorry if...
There, there, he said. Death comes to us all, you know, old and young alike.
Was he threatening me, or was my imagination overheated?
And even though we expect it, he went on, it always comes as a shock in the end.
It certainly had for Rupert, but was the man being facetious?
Evidently not, for his long face maintained its professional polish.
And now, if you will excuse me, he said, I must prepare him for his final journey.
Final journey? Where did they get this claptrap? Was there a phrase book published for the undertaking trade? I gave him my 10 years old going on 11 smile and faked a flustered exit.
The bell above the door of the St. Nicholas tea room jangled merrily as I stepped inside. The establishment, a bit of a climb at the top of the stairs, was owned by none other than Miss Lavinia and Miss Aurelia, the Paddock sisters, those same two relics who had provided the musical prelude to Rupert's spectacular demise. Miss Lavinia, in a nook at the far side of the room, seemed to be locked in mortal combat with a large silver samovar. In spite of the simplicity of its task, which was the boiling of water, this Heath Robinson contraption was a bulbous squid of tubes, valves and gauges which spat hot water as it gurgled and hissed away like a cornered dragon.
No tea, I'm afraid, she said over her shoulder. She could not yet see who had entered the shop.
Anything I can do to help, Miss Paddock? I offered cheerily.
She let out a little shriek as her hand strayed accidentally into a jet of hot steam and the china cup she was holding crashed to the floor, where it flew into 100 pale pieces.
Oh, it's the little Deluce girl, she said, spinning round. My goodness, you gave me quite a fright. I wasn't expecting to hear your voice.
Because I could see that she'd scalded her hand, I fought back my baser urges.
Anything I can do to help? I repeated.
Oh, dear, she said, flustered beyond reason. Peter always chooses to act up when Aurelia's not here. She's so much better with him than I am.
Peter? I asked.
The samovar, she said, wiping her wet red hands on a tea towel. Peter the Great.
Here, I said, let me.
Without another word, I took up a bowl of lemon wedges from one of the round tables and squeezed each of them into a jug of iced water. Then I grabbed a clean white table napkin, immersed it until it was soaked, wrung it out, and wrapped it around Miss Puddock's hand. She flinched as I touched her and then relaxed.
May I? I asked, removing an opal brooch from her lapel and using it to pin the ends of the makeshift bandage.
Oh, it feels better already, she said with a pained smile. Wherever did you learn that trick?
Girl guides, I lied.
Experience has taught me that an unexpected answer is often better than the truth. I had, in fact, quite painfully looked up the remedy in one of Mrs. Mullet's household reference books after a superheated test tube seared most of the flesh from a couple of my fingers.
Miss Cool has always spoken so highly of you, she said. I shall tell her she was bang on, as those nice bomber boys from the RAF used to say.
I gave her my most modest smile.
It's nothing, Miss Puddock. Just jolly good luck I got here when I did. I was next door at Mr. Sowbell's, you see, saying a prayer or two at Mr. Pawson's coffin. You don't suppose it will do any harm, do you?
I realized that I was gilding the lily with a string mop for a paintbrush, but business was business.
Why, no, dear, she said. I think Mr. Pawson would be touched.
She didn't know the half of it.
It was so sad.
I lowered my voice to a conspiratorial whisper and touched her good arm.
But I must tell you, Miss Paddock, that in spite of the tragedy on Saturday evening, my family and I enjoyed Napoleon's last charge and Bendemeer's stream. Father said that you don't often hear music like that nowadays.
Why, thank you, dear. She murmured damply. It's kind of you to say so. Of course, mercifully, we didn't actually see what happened to poor Mr. Pawson, being busy in the kitchen, as it were. As proprietresses of Bishop Lacey's sole tea room, certain expectations attach, I'm afraid. Not that we resent.
No, of course not, I said.
But surely you must have tons of people offering to help out.
She gave a little bark.
Help? Most people don't know the meaning of the word. No, Aurelia and I were left alone in the kitchen from start to finish. 263 cups of tea we poured. But of course that's counting the ones we served after the police took charge.
And no one offered to help? I asked, giving her an incredulous look.
No one. As I said, Aurelia and I were alone in the kitchen the whole while. And I was left completely on my own when Aurelia took a cup of tea to the puppeteer. My ears went up like a flag on a pole.
She took Rupert a cup of tea?
Well, she tried to, dear, but the door was locked.
The door to the stage? Across from the kitchen?
No, no, she didn't want to use that one. She'd have to brush right past that Mother Goose. That woman who is in the spotlight, telling the story. No, Aurelia took the tea all the way round the back of the hall and down to the other door.
The one in the opposite passage?
Well, yes, it's the only other one, isn't it, dear? But as I've already told you, it was locked.
During the puppet show?
Why, yes. Odd, isn't it? Mr. Pawson had asked us before he began if we could bring him a nice cup of tea during the show. Just leave it on the little table behind the stage, he said. I'll find it. Puppetry's dry work, you know. And he gave us a little wink. So why on earth would he lock the door?
As she went on, I could already feel the facts beginning to marshal themselves in my mind.
Those were Aurelia's exact words when she'd come all the way back with his cup of tea still in her hand. Whatever would possess him to lock the door?
Perhaps he didn't, I said, with sudden inspiration. Perhaps someone else did. Who has the key, do you know?
There are two keys to the stage door, dear.
they each open the ones on either side of the stage. The vicar keeps one on his keychain and the duplicate on a nail in his study at the vicarage. It's all because of that time he went off to Brighton for the C&S, that's the Church Wardens and Sidemen's cricket match, and took Tom Stoddart with him. Tom's a locksmith, you know, and with the two of them gone, no one could get on or off the stage without a stepladder. It played havoc with the little theatre group's production of King Lear, let me tell you.
And there was no one else about?
No one, dear. Aurelia and I were in the kitchen the whole time. We had the door half closed so the light from the kitchen wouldn't spoil the darkness in the hall.
There was no one in the passageway?
No, of course not. They should have had to walk through the beam of light from the kitchen door, right under our noses, so to speak. Once we had the water on to boil, Aurelia and I stood right there at the crack of the door so that we could at least hear the puppet show. Fee-fi-fo-fum! Oh, it gives me the goosebumps just to think about it now.
I stood perfectly still and held my breath, not moving a muscle. I kept my mouth shut and let the silence lengthen.
Except, she said, her gaze wavering, I thought...
Yes?
I thought I heard a footstep in the hall. I just glanced over at the wall clock and my eyes were a little dazzled by the light above the stove. I looked out and saw...
Do you remember the time?
It was 7:25. We had the tea laid on for 8 o'clock, and it takes those big electric urns a long time to come to the boil.
How odd that you should ask.
That nice young policeman, what's his name, the little blonde fellow with the dimples and the lovely smile?
Detective Sergeant Graves, I said.
Yes, that's him, Detective Sergeant Graves.
Funny, isn't it?
He asked me the same question, and I gave him the same answer I'm going to give you.
Which is?
It was the vicar's wife, Cynthia Richardson.
Chapter 25. Cynthia, the rodent-faced avenger. I should have known. Cynthia, who doled out good works in the parish of St. Tancred's with the hand of a Herod. I could easily see her taking it upon herself to punish Rupert, the notorious womanizer. The parish hall was part of her kingdom. The spare key to the stage doors was kept on a nail in her husband's study. How she might have come into possession of the vicar's missing bicycle clip remained something of a mystery. But mightn't it have been in the vicarage all along? By his own admission, the vicar's absent-mindedness was becoming a problem. Hence the engraved initials. Perhaps he had left home without the clip last Thursday and shredded his trouser cuff because he wasn't wearing it. The details were unimportant. One thing I was sure of, there was more going on in the vicarage than met the eye, and whatever it was, husband dancing naked in the woods and so forth, it seemed likely that Cynthia was at the heart of it all.
What are you thinking, dear?
Miss Puddock's voice interrupted my thoughts.
You've suddenly gone so quiet.
I needed time to get to the bottom of things, and I needed it now. I was unlikely to have a second chance to plumb the depths of Miss Puddock's village knowledge.
I suddenly don't feel very well, I said, snatching at the edge of a table and lowering myself into one of the wire-backed chairs. It might have been the sight of your poor scalded hand, Miss Puddock. A delayed reaction, perhaps, a touch of shock.
I suppose there must have been times when I hated myself for practicing such deceits, but I could not think of any at the moment. It was fate, after all, who thrust me into these things, and fate would jolly well have to stand the blame.
Oh, you poor thing, Miss Puddock said. You stay right where you are, and I shall fetch you a nice cup of tea and a scone. You do like scones, don't you?
I love scones, I said, remembering suddenly that shock victims were known to shiver and shake.
By the time she came back with the scones, my teeth were chattering like marbles shaken in a jar. She removed a vase of Lily of the Valley, Convallaria Magalis, whisked the starched linen cloth from one of the tables, and wrapped it round my shoulders. As the sweet smell of the flowers wafted across my nostrils, I remembered with pleasure that the plant contained a witch's brew of cardioactive glycosides, including convalotoxin and glucoconvalocide, and that even the water in which the flowers had stood was poisonous. Our ancestors had called it Our Lady's Tears, or Ladder to Heaven, and with good reason. "You mustn't take a chill," Miss Puddock clucked solicitously as she poured me a cup of tea from the hulking samovar. "Peter the Great seems to be behaving himself now," I observed with a calculated tremor and a nod towards the gleaming machine. "He's very naughty sometimes," she smiled. "It comes of his being Russian, I expect." "Is he really Russian?" I asked, priming the pump. "From his distinguished heads," she said, pointing to the double-headed black eagle that functioned as a hot water tap, "to his royally rounded bottom. He was manufactured in the shops of the brothers Martiniuk, the celebrated silversmiths of Odessa, and it was said that he was once used to make tea for Tsar Nicholas and his unfortunate daughters. When the city was occupied by the Reds after the revolution, the youngest of the Martiniuks, Vladimir, who was just 16 at the time, bundled Peter up in a wolfskin, roped him to a handcart, and fled with him on foot. On foot, fancy! To the Netherlands, where he set up shop in one of Amsterdam's cobbled alleys, and changed his name to Vandenmarten. Peter," she said, giving the samovar a light but affectionate pat, "was his sole possession, other than the handcart, of course. He planned to make his fortune by producing endless copies and selling them to Dutch aristocrats, who were said to be mad about Russian tea." "And were they?" I asked. "I don't know," she replied. "And nor did Vladimir. He died of influenza in the great epidemic of 1918, leaving his shop and all that was in it to his landlady, Margriet von Rhein. Margriet married a farm boy from Bishop's Lacey, Arthur Elkins, who had fought in Flanders, and he brought her back with him to England not long after the end of the Great War. Arthur was killed when a factory chimney collapsed on him in 1924, and Margriet died of shock when they brought her the news. After her death, my sister and I found that she had willed us Peter the Great, and there was nothing for it but to open the St. Nicholas Tea Room. 25 years ago, that was, and as you can see, we're still here. He's a very temperamental old samovar, you know," she went on, moving as if to caress his silver surface, but thinking better of it. "Of course, he's an awful old fraud. Oh, he spits boiling water and blows out fuses on occasion. But underneath it all, he has a heart of gold, or at least of silver." "He's quite magnificent," I said. "And doesn't he know it? Well, well, here I am talking about him as if he were a cat. When Grace was with us, she used to call him the tyrant. Imagine that. The tyrant wants his polishing, she'd say. The tyrant wants his electrical contacts cleaned."
"Grace?" I asked.
"Grace Tennyson, or Ingleby, as she is now."
"Grace Ingleby used to work here?"
"Oh, yes. Until she left to marry Gordon, she was our star waitress. You wouldn't think it to look at her, but she was as strong as an ox. You don't often see that in such a tiny bit of a thing. And she wasn't the slightest bit intimidated by Peter and his moods. Spark and spit as he may, Grace was never afraid to roll up her sleeves and have a good rummage round his innards."
"She sounds very clever," I said.
"She was all of that," Miss Puddock laughed. "All that and more. And no wonder. One of our customers once told us,
An RAF squadron leader, I think he was, and in confidence, of course, that Grace had the highest IQ he'd ever seen in the fairer sex, as he put it. That if the people in special operations hadn't whisked her off to do top secret work, she might well have spent the rest of the war installing wireless sets in Spitfires.
Top secret work? I gasped. The thought of Grace Ingleby doing anything other than cringing in her dovecote tower, like a captive maiden waiting to be rescued by Sir Lancelot, was almost laughable.
Of course, she would never breathe a word about it.
Miss Paddock lowered her voice in the way that people often do when they talk about the war.
They're not allowed to, you know. But then, we seldom see her nowadays, since that tragedy with her little boy.
Robin, I said.
Yes.
Since then, she keeps to herself. I'm afraid she's not at all the same laughing girl who used to put Peter the Great in his place.
Was Gordon a member of Special Operations too? I asked.
Gordon? She laughed. Good Lord, no. Gordon's a farmer born and a farmer he shall die, as Shakespeare wrote. Or was it Harry Lauder? Or George Formby? Or someone like that? My memory's gone all wormholes. And so will yours in time.
I couldn't think what to say, and I saw at once she thought she'd offended me.
But not for many a year, dear. No, I'm quite sure your memory will still be going strong when the rest of us are in our graves and paved over for parking at the bowling palaces.
Have you seen Mrs. Ingleby recently? I asked.
Not since Saturday night at the parish hall. Of course, I had no opportunity to chat, what with our little musicale on my mind. The rest of the evening was a nightmare, wasn't it? The death of that poor man, the puppet that was carved with Robin's face. I don't know what Gordon was thinking, bringing Grace there when she's so fragile. But then, he had no way of knowing, did he?
No. I said, I don't suppose he did. By the time I set out for Buckshaw, it was well past lunchtime. Fortunately, Miss Paddock had wrapped a couple of buttered scones in paper and insisted upon tucking them into my pocket. I nibbled at them absently as I pedalled along the road, lost in thought. At the end of the high street, the road made a gentle angle to the southwest as it skirted the southern perimeter of St. Tancred's churchyard. If I hadn't glanced to my right, I mightn't have seen it. The Austin van, with Porson's puppets in gold letters on its panels, parked at the side of the parish hall. Gladys's tires skidded in the dust as I applied her handbrakes and swerved into the churchyard. As I pulled up, Nia was stowing odds and ends in the van's interior.
"You've got it running," I shouted.
She gave me the kind of look that you might give to a bit of dog dirt in your porridge, and went on with her packing.
"It's me, Flavia," I said. "Have you forgotten me already?"
"Piss off, you little traitor," she snapped. "Leave me alone." For an instant, I thought I was back at Buckshaw, talking to Feely. It was the kind of dismissal I've lived through 1,000 times and survived, I thought. I decided to stand my ground.
"Why? What have I done to you?"
"Oh, come off it, Flavia. You know as well as I do. You told the police I was at Buckshaw. They thought I was hiding out, or running away, or whatever you want to call it."
"I did no such thing," I protested. "I haven't laid eyes on a policeman since I saw you in the coach house."
"But you were the only one who knew I was there." As it always did when I was angry, my mind burned with crystal clarity. "I knew you were there, Dogger knew you were there, and so did Mrs. Mullet, to name but three." I can hardly believe Dogger would peach on me.
"And nor would Mrs. Mullet," I said.
"Good Lord, was I actually defending Mrs. M?"
"She may be a bloody gossip, but she's not mean," I said.
She'd never rat on you. Inspector Hewitt came to Buckshaw, probably to ask me a few more questions about Saturday night, and happened to see you walking from the coach house to the kitchen. There's no more to it than that, I'm sure of it. I could see that Nia was thinking about it. I wanted nothing more than to take her by the shoulders and give her a good shaking. But I had to keep in mind the fact that her emotions were being stoked by a storm of hormones, fierce clouds of hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, and sulfur, combining and recombining in the eternal dances of life. It almost made me forgive her. "Here," I said, pulling the butterfly compact dramatically from my pocket and holding it out towards her. "I believe this belongs to you." I hugged myself in anticipation of a tidal wave of gratitude and praise. But none came. "Thanks," Nia said, and pocketed the thing. "Thanks? Just thanks?" The nerve! I'd show her. I'd pretend she hadn't hurt me. Pretend I didn't care. "I can't help noticing," I remarked casually, "that you're packing the van, which means that Bert Archer's repaired it and you're about to be on your way. Since Inspector Hewitt is nowhere in sight, I expect that means you're free to go."
"Free?" she repeated and spat in the dirt. "Free? The vicar's given me £4.06.08 from the show. Bert Archer's bill comes to £7.10. It's only because the vicar put in a word for me that he's willing to let me drive to Overton to pawn whatever I can. If you call that free, then I'm free. It's all bloody well and good for little Miss Nabob, who lives in a country house the size of Buckingham Palace, to make her smart pants deductions. So think what you like, but don't bloody well patronize me."
"All right," I said. "I didn't mean to." "Here, take this, please." I dug into my pocket again and pulled out the coin, the one Aunt Felicity had foisted upon Dogger, thinking it was a shilling. Dogger, in turn, had planted it in my pocket, believing, perhaps, that it would soon be spent on whorehound sticks at Miss Cool's shop. I handed it to Nia, who looked at it with disbelief.
"Fourpence," she said. "Bloody fourpence."
Her tears were flowing freely as she flung it away among the tombstones.
"Yes, it is only fourpence," I said. "But it's fourpence in Mandy money. The coins are produced by the Royal Mint to be handed out by the Sovereign."
"Blow the Sovereign," she shouted, "and blow the Royal Mint on Mandy Thursday. They're quite rare. If I remember correctly, Bert Archer is a coin collector, and I think you'll find the Mandy fourpence will more than pay for the van." With all the righteous dignity I could muster, I grabbed Gladys by the handlebars and shoved off for home. When I looked back from the corner of the church, Nia was already on her hands and knees, scrabbling in the churchyard grass, and I couldn't tell whether the tears she was wiping away were tears of anger or of happiness. Chapter 26. "All right, Dogger," I said. "The jig is up." I had found him in the butler's pantry, polishing Father's shoes. Dogger's duties at Buckshaw varied in direct proportion to his present capabilities, his participation in our daily life rising and descending, rather like those coloured balls in Galileo's thermometer that float at different levels in a glass tube, depending on the temperature. The fact that he was doing shoes was a good sign. It indicated clearly that he had advanced once again from gardener to butler. He looked up from his work.
"Is it?" he asked.
"Cast your mind, if you please, back to Saturday evening at the parish hall. You're sitting beside me watching Jack and the Beanstalk when suddenly something goes wrong backstage. Rupert comes crashing down dead, and within minutes you are telling me that you fear we have seen murder. How did you know that? How did you know it wasn't an accident?" This question had been gnawing away at my subconscious like a rat at a rope, but until that very moment, I had not been fully aware of it.
Dogger breathed on the upper of one of Father's regimental half-Wellingtons before he answered, giving the glassy black surface a final loving rub with his shirt sleeve.
"The circumstances spoke against it," he said. "Mr. Pawson was a perfectionist. He manufactured all his own equipment. A puppeteer works in the dark. There's no room for error. A frayed electrical wire was out of the question."
"It wasn't frayed," I said. "I spotted it when I was backstage with Inspector Hewitt. The insulation was scraped away."
"I should have been surprised if it wasn't," he said.
"Congratulations on a brilliant deduction," I said, "although it's one that didn't occur to me." "And it certainly hadn't, because the female mind doesn't work that way. Seen from the air, the male mind must look rather like the canals of Europe, with ideas being towed along well-worn towpaths by heavy-footed dray horses. There is never any doubt that they will, despite wind and weather, reach their destinations by following a simple series of connected lines. But the female mind, even in my limited experience, seems more of a vast and teeming swamp, but a swamp that knows in an instant whenever a stranger, even miles away, has so much as dipped a single toe into her waters. People who talk about this phenomenon, most of whom know nothing whatsoever about it, call it woman's intuition. Although I had arrived at much the same conclusion as Dogger, it had been by a very different route. In the first place, although it was obvious that Rupert had been murdered for what he had done to a woman, I think I had known almost from the moment of his death that Nia was not his killer. "The instant he came crashing down onto the stage," I said, "Nia leaped to her feet and moved towards him. Her first and automatic impulse was to go to his aid." Dogger rubbed his chin and nodded. "But she forced herself to stop," I went on. "As soon as she saw the smoke and the sparks, she quickly realized that touching any part of his body could mean instant death. For her and her baby." "Yes," Dogger said, "I noticed that too. Therefore, Nia is not the murderer." "I believe you can safely remove her from your list," said Dogger. It wasn't until I was halfway along the road to Culverhouse Farm that I realized how tired I was. I'd been up before the sun and had been going flat out ever since. But time was of the essence. If I didn't get there before Inspector Hewitt, I wouldn't know the gruesome details until I read about them in the news of the world. This time, rather than crossing the river behind the church, I had decided to go round by the Hindley Road and approach the farm from the west. By doing so, I would have the advantage of height to survey the terrain, as well as keeping to the cover of Gibbet Wood. Now that the noose was tightening, so to speak, it would never do to be ambushed by a cold-blooded killer. By the time I was halfway up the chalky road of Gibbet Hill, I felt as if my blood were mud and my shoes were made of lead. Under any other circumstances, I might have crawled into a quiet thicket for a nap, but it was not to be. Time was running out and, as Father was so fond of saying, tired is a mucker's excuse. As I listened to the wind sighing and whispering in the treetops of Gibbet Wood, I found myself half hoping that Mad Meg would leap out and divert me from my mission. But this too was not to be. Aside from a yellow hammer tapping away like a busy shoemaker at the far side of the wood, there were no signs of life. When I reached the top of the hill, Jubilee Field sloped away from me towards the river, a blanket of electric blue. At the outbreak of war, Gordon had been made to grow flax, or so Mrs. Mallet had told me, by order of HM Government, who required the stuff to manufacture parachutes. But the Battle of Britain had been years ago, and parachutes were no longer required in anywhere near the same quantity. Still, working under the cloak of wartime necessity, it seemed that Gordon had managed to keep his secret crop of cannabis tucked handily away among the trees of Gibbet Wood, its very existence known to no more than a handful of people. Which one of them, I wondered, if it was one of them, besides hating him passionately enough to kill, possessed sufficient electrical knowledge to have put the jolt to Rupert Pawson? A flash of light caught my eye, a reflection from the side of the road. I saw at once that it was one of Mad Meg's roadside junk ornaments, dangling by a string from a bramble bush. It was no more than a jagged bit of chrome trim, jarred loose from the radiator of some passing motor car by the roughness of the road. Hanging beneath it and twisting idly in the sun, it was this that had caught my eye, was a small ridged circular disc of silver which, judging by its red stains, had once been the lid on a half-pint tin of paint. It reminded me, oddly enough, of something I had experienced the previous year when Father had taken Ophelia, Daphne and me up to London for midnight mass at the Brompton Oratory. At the elevation of the host, as the priest held the round white wafer, which some of us believed to be the body of Christ, above his head for an inordinately long time, it had for just an instant caught the light from the candles and the coloured reflections of the chancel, glowing with an unearthly iridescent sheen that was neither solid nor vaporous. At the time, it had seemed to me a signal that something momentous was about to happen. Now, at the verge of Gibbet Wood, the oiled teeth of some mental cogwheel fell into place with a series of almost audible clicks. Church, click. Vicar, click. Circle suspended, click. Bicycle clip, click. Paint lid, click. Meg, click. And I saw, as if in a blinding vision, the vicar had been here at Culver House Farm last Thursday. It was here that he had caught his trouser leg in the bicycle chain and lost his clip. He had been wearing it after all, and it was here in the chalky dust that he had taken a tumble. The white smudges on his black clerical garb had come from this very road. Mad Meg, the perennial magpie, had found the clip, as she did with all shiny metallic objects dropped in the vicinity of Gibbet Wood, and Meg had picked it up and brought it with her to the vicarage. "Her turned me out, took old Meg's bracelet and turned her out. Dirty, dirty." Meg's words echoed in my memory. She had been talking about the vicar's wife. It was Cynthia Richardson who had taken the bicycle clip, Meg's bracelet, away from her and shooed her out of the vicarage. From the vicarage, it was only a hop, step and jump to the parish hall, where the thing turned up backstage as the murder weapon in Rupert's puppet theatre. That's the way it must have happened. I was sure of it, as sure as my name is Flavia Deluce, and I could hardly wait to tell Inspector Hewitt. Below me, in the distance, on the far shore of a sea of blue flax, a grey Ferguson tractor was creeping slowly alongside a stone wall, towing a flatbed trailer in its wake. A flash of blonde hair in the sunlight told me that the man on foot, unloading stones for wall mending, must be Dieter, and there was no doubt that the person in overalls at the tractor's wheel was Sally. Even if they had been paying attention, which they weren't, they were too far away to spot me slinking down towards the farmhouse. As I moved cautiously across the courtyard, the place seemed sunken in shadow. Old stone piled upon old stone, with dead-eyed windows, as Sally had said, staring out blindly upon nothing. Which of the blank panes, I wondered, had been Robin's bedroom? Which of the empty windows had framed his lonely little face before that unthinkable Monday in September of 1945, when his short life had ended so abruptly at the end of a rope? I gave a token knock at the door and waited a respectful 30 seconds. At the end of that time, I turned the knob and stepped inside. "Mrs. Ingleby," I called. "Mr. Ingleby, it's me, Flavia. I've come to see if you have any extra large eggs."
I didn't think there would be a reply, and I was right. Gordon Ingleby was far too hard-working to be mooning about his house while there was still a trace of daylight outside. And Grace, well, Grace was either in her dovecot tower or wandering the hills. The inquisitive Mrs. Mullet had once asked me if I ever came upon her in my rambles about the Shire. "She's a queer one, that Grace Ingleby," she'd said. "My friend Edith, that's Edith Crowley, dear, her as was Edith Fisher before she married Jack, was walking over to a choir practor's appointment in Nether Stowell. She'd missed the bus, you see, and she spotted Grace Ingleby coming out of a copse at the bottom of Biddy's Lane, which goes over the hill to nowhere. "Grace," she called out to her, "you-hoo, Grace Ingleby." But Grace slithered through a stile. Those are her very words, slithered through a stile, if you can picture it, and by the time she got there herself, Grace was gone. "Gone like a dog's breath in December," that's what she said. When it came to village gossip, Mrs. M was infallible, like Pope Pius IX. I moved slowly along the corridor, fairly confident that I was alone in the house. At the end of the hall, beside a round window, a grandfather clock was talking away to itself, the only sound in the otherwise silent farmhouse. I looked quickly into each room, parlour, cloakroom, kitchen, pantry. Beside the clock, two steps led up to a small square landing, and by peering round the corner, I could see that a narrow stairway continued upwards to the first floor. Tucked in beneath the stairs was a cupboard, its oddly angled door of dovetailed boards fitted out with a splendid doorknob of green and white china that could only have been Wedgwood. I would have a jolly good dig through it later. Each step gave out its own distinctive wooden groan as I ascended, like a series of old coffin lids being pried open, I thought, with a pleasant shudder. "Steady on, Flave, old girl. No sense getting the wind up." At the top of the stairs was a second small landing from which, at right angles, another three steps led to the upstairs corridor. It seemed obvious that all the rooms up here were bedrooms, and I was right. A glance into each of the first two revealed cold, Spartan chambers, each with a single bed, a washstand, a wardrobe, and nothing more. The large bedroom at the front of the house was Gordon and Grace's, no doubt about it. Aside from a double dresser and a double bed with a shabby quilt, this room was as cold and sterile as the others. I had a quick snoop in the dresser drawers. On his side, socks, underwear, a wristwatch with no strap, and a greasy, much-thumbed deck of playing cards bearing the crest of the Scots Greys. On hers, slips, knickers, a bottle of prescription sleeping ampules, my old friend chloral hydrate, I noted, C2H3Cl3O2, a powerful hypnotic that when slipped in alcohol to American thugs was called a Mickey Finn. In England, it was slipped to high-strung housewives by country doctors and called something to help you sleep. I couldn't keep back a quick smile as I thought of the time that, using no more than alcohol, lavatory cleaner, and a bottle of chlorine bleach, I had synthesized a batch of the stuff and given it, inside a doctored apple, to Phoebe Snow, a prize pig belonging to our neighbour, Max White. Phoebe had taken 5 days and 17 hours to sleep it off and, for a while, the remarkable sleeping pig had been the 8th wonder of the British agricultural world. Max had graciously lent her for the fete at St. Tancred's, where Phoebe could be viewed, for 6 pence a time, snoring in the back of a lorry marked Sleeping Beauty. In the end, she had raised nearly £5 for the choir's surplus fund. With a sigh, I returned to my work. At the back of Grace's drawer, tucked beneath a soiled linen handkerchief, was a well-thumbed Bible. I flipped open the cover and read the words on its flyleaf. "Please return to the parish church of St. Tancred's, Bishop's Lacey." As I was putting it back into the drawer, a slip of paper fell out and fluttered to the floor.
I picked it up with my fingernails, taking great care not to leave my dabs on the thing. The words were written in purple ink. Grace, please call if I may provide any further solace. And it was signed Denwin. Denwin Richardson, the vicar, whom Mad Meg had seen dancing naked in nearby Gibbet Wood. I pocketed the evidence. All that was left now was a small bedroom at the back of the house. Robin's bedroom. It had to be. I made my way across the silent landing and stopped in front of the closed door. It was only then that I began to feel a little apprehension. What if Gordon or Grace suddenly stormed into the house and up the stairs? How could I possibly explain my invasion of their bedrooms? I put an ear to the door's dark panelling and listened. Not a sound. I turned the knob and stepped inside. As I had suspected, the room was Robin's, but it was the room of a little boy who had been dead 5 years. A pathetically small bed, folded blankets, an empty wardrobe, and linoleum on the floor. No shrine, no candles, no framed pictures of the deceased astride a rocking horse or hanging from his knees in an apple tree. What a bitter disappointment. It was as bare and simple as Van Gogh's bedroom in Arles, but without the warmth, the room was as cold and impersonal as a winter moon. After a quick look round, there was no more to see, and I stepped outside, closing the door respectfully, almost tenderly, behind me. And then I heard a footstep downstairs. What was I to do? The possibilities flashed across my brain. I could gallop down the stairs in tears, pretending I had become lost and disoriented while sleepwalking. I could claim I was suffering a nervous breakdown and didn't know where I was, that I had seen, from the farmyard, a face at an upstairs window beckoning me with a long finger, that I had thought it was Grace Ingleby in distress. Interesting though they were, these actions would all come with consequences, and if there was one thing I did not need, it was to introduce complications to my life. No, I thought, I would sneak down the stairs and hope like mad that I would not be caught. But the idea died almost before it was born. The instant I put my foot on it, the top step gave out a ghastly groan. There was a flapping near the bottom of the stairs, as if a large bird were trapped in the house. I went slowly, but steadily, down the rest of the staircase. At the bottom, I stuck my head round the corner and my blood ran cold. A beam of bright sunlight illuminated the end of the hallway. In it, a little boy in rubber boots and a sailor suit was vanishing through the open door. Chapter 27. I was sure of it. He had been in the cupboard beneath the stairs all along. I stood there, stock still at the open door, faced with a dilemma. What should I do? I knew for certain that once I stepped outside this farmhouse, I would not be likely to enter it ever again. Best to have a quick look behind the angled door now, before setting off in pursuit of the sailor-suited apparition. Inside the dim cupboard, a length of string dangled from a naked bulb. I gave it a tug and the space sprang to feeble light. It was empty. Empty, that is, except for a pair of child's rubber boots, very much like the ones I had just seen on the feet of the figure in the doorway. The chief difference was that this pair of Dunlops was clodded with clay, still wet from the morning's rain. Or the grave. As I dashed through the open front door, I caught a glimpse of the navy blue sailor suit just disappearing behind the machine shed. Beyond those rusty galvanized walls, I knew, was a bewildering warren of outbuildings, a maze of sagging sheds, any one of which could easily provide a dozen hiding places. Off I loped in pursuit, like a hound on the scent. It never occurred to me to be afraid. But then I slid to a sudden stop. Behind the machine shed, a narrow alley led off to the right. Had the fugitive darted down it to throw me off the track? I edged along the narrow passage, taking great care not to touch the neglected walls on either side.
A single scratch from any one of the razor-sharp flaps of ripped tin would almost certainly end in tetanus, and I would end up hog-tied in a hospital ward, foaming at the mouth and racked by bone-breaking spasms. How happy Daffy and Feely would be.
"I told you she would come to no good end," Daffy would tell Father. "She should never have been allowed to run loose."
Accordingly, I inched slowly, crab-wise, along the narrow passage. When I finally reached the end, I found my way blocked on the left by a stack of battered petrol drums, on my right by a nettle-ridden pig pen. As I edged back along the passage of death, which seemed, if anything, even more narrow on the